Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2011, as the Arab Spring was sweeping through the Middle East and North Africa, millions of Syrians joined the historic moment and took to the streets demanding democracy, political pluralism, the release of political prisoners, and social and economic justice. But shortly thereafter, the brutality of the Assad regime, the role of regional and international players, and the rise of ISIS turned Syria's hopeful uprising into the nightmare that we are witnessing today. Over the past 5 years, over 300,000 Syrians have been killed, nearly 500,000 live under siege, 4 out of 5 live in poverty, 8 million have fled the country. This is according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. So how did a revolutionary mass movement turn so deadly? And what has happened to the people and the activists who took part in those 2011 protests? In their new book, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War, today's guests, Robin Yassin Kassab and Leila Alshami, explore the realities of life and war in Syria by providing firsthand testimonies from opposition fighters, exiles, refugees, and courageous human rights activists who are still inside Syria. Leila Alshami is a human rights activist and founding member of Tahrir ICN, that's a network connecting anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. Robin Yassin Kassab is a media commentator on Syria and author of the acclaimed novel, The Road from Damascus. Leila Alshami and Robin Yassin Kassab join us from the studios of WBEZ Radio in Chicago. Hi, Leila and Robin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Good morning. Well, congratulations on your book. You give a voice to ordinary Syrians and activists that are missing from most of the coverage we're getting here in the United States. It feels like their voices have gradually disappeared and have been replaced by the larger narrative about the geopolitics of the Syrian war. Leila, talk a little bit about what inspired you to get involved in this project.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I think both myself and Robin felt that the discussion on Syria was very much dominated by geopolitical discussions, by discussions about the rise of Islamization in Syria, about groups such as ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. And in all of these debates and discussions about Syria, what was really missing were Syrian voices themselves. How did Syrians on the ground view their own situation? How did they define their own struggle? And we really wanted to give a platform to that voice, because people in Syria over the past 5 years have been involved in such courageous and inspiring actions to try to bring about radical change in their society. And we really wanted to highlight those voices.
And Robin, what would you add to that? What inspired you to get involved?
Well, the same thing. I mean, of course, as any Syrian or anybody connected to Syria in the last 5 years, we've been dragged away from our daily lives and had our heads banged against the table by this drama that's happening in there. We have family members, friends inside Syria. We've kept in touch with what's happening, and we've heard these very dramatic stories. We're aware of these remarkable attempts to build alternatives to the authoritarian state in Syria. And we felt that the media representations were really, in general, you know, with some great exceptions, in general, media representations were very, very weak, very orientalist, and usually very inaccurate. And so many people, when it comes to the Middle East, they feel that they already know what's going on. They arrive with their pre-existent big stories, grand narratives, which don't actually work. And they stick to these stories and don't bother talking to the people on the ground. If they do go into Syria, a lot of journalists just stick with their regime minders and their boring old stories and don't talk to Syrians. So we felt we wanted to try and fill that gap a little bit.
Do you both have friends and family who are still inside Syria?
Yes.
Yes, we do.
And so talk about, how do you communicate with them and what are they dealing with? Because we hear from the refugees, and just on the BBC, we were hearing about the so-called ceasefire talks, and we'll talk about that later in the show. But I really want to spend the first part of the show focusing on the people inside of Syria. So, Leila, tell us about some of your friends and family who are still inside of Syria. What are you hearing from them?
Well, when I speak to my family, they're living in regime-controlled areas, so I don't actually get that much news from them. We tend to stick to pleasantries, how's the situation? I mean, they give information about the economic situation is becoming increasingly difficult for them. It's difficult to move around the area that they're in because of the checkpoints. But we don't really touch on the more political issues because obviously they're worried about people listening into that phone conversation. But then with friends and activists, we talk very freely, people that are based in liberated territories, and we manage to communicate on Skype or on social media or through email, and they manage to talk quite openly, and they're facing a very difficult situation. I mean, they're under relentless attacks, relentless barrel bombs. Often the humanitarian situation has rapidly deteriorated over the past 5 years. So it's a very difficult situation for people inside the country. But people are still committed to this process of change, and people are still engaging in really amazing work in Syria, and that's something that's often not spoken about.
Can you tell us more about these regime-controlled areas?
Well, I mean, the areas there's areas in Syria which are still under control of the government, Damascus being one of them, and life there for people is more secure, security-wise, because the government is not bombing the areas which it has control over. Many people from other parts of the country have had to flee to regime-controlled areas in search of safety, because it is the liberated areas which are the areas which are under relentless assault. But life is difficult for people in those areas. People are very concerned about the situation in their country. They're very concerned about the direction that the conflict is taking. And things are difficult economically for people. People have had difficulties buying gas, difficulties continuing to work, issues like that.
Yeah, at the moment, I think the regime controls between a fifth and a quarter of the country, of the land area of Syria. It was down to a lot less than that before the Russian intervention and the Russian carpet bombing of the liberated areas. But it's basically central Damascus, not the suburbs of Damascus, which are liberated. Central Damascus, the road up through the city of Homs, the third biggest city, which is now largely depopulated and destroyed, but it's in regime control. And then up to the coast, cities like Tartus and Latakia on the coast, which are still under regime control, half of Aleppo and little bits of other parts of the country are still under the control of the regime and its international allies.
And Robin, what are you hearing from your family members? How often are you able to connect with them?
Well, we do talk by phone. It's very similar to what Leila says. People talk in a kind of code. I mean, I don't know if it's still the case that the secret services are still listening to every international phone call, but people often believe that it is. They're still scared that it is. So we don't tend to have very in-depth conversations. The code that people talk in, people will say things to you like, "Oh, a bird flew over my shoulder yesterday," which may mean that there was some aerial bombardment nearby, or it was a very noisy last night, which means there was fighting nearby last night. You know, the code like this. But in general, it's not that easy to talk to people on the phone who are in regime-controlled areas. People who are in liberated areas, it is a lot easier to communicate with them through Skype and so on.
This is kind of a big question, but I think it's really important because we tend to get clips and headlines in the United States. Now, you write about how in 2011, as the Arab Spring swept through the Middle East and North Africa, millions of Syrians joined that moment. They took to the streets. They demanded democracy. They demanded social and economic justice. And then here we are just 5 years later, and we've done a lot of shows on Syria, and we often say that it's on the brink of collapse. So how do you explain what happened to people who are not following this very closely? Leila, why don't you go first?
Well, you're right. People took to the streets in the wake of the Arab Spring. Syria was originally a bit different from places like Tunisia and Egypt because people did not immediately call for the fall of the regime. People were originally calling for democratic reforms. But the state responded to those calls with massive amounts of violence, and that really caused the protest movement to spread geographically. It started spreading across the whole country with very large numbers of people participating. And it also caused people to radicalise. People started calling for the fall of the regime. They realised at that point that the regime would not reform, that its response was solely a violent response. And then as the violence escalated, as the regime was shooting peaceful protesters carried out massive sweeping arrests of people involved in the protest movement and also carried out a massive rape campaign during that early period of the protest movement. People picked up arms to defend themselves. They really wanted to protect their families and their communities from assault, and it was that which really caused the militarisation of the uprising, which has escalated to the situation we see today.
Why did the regime crack down so hard?
I would argue that the regime deliberately wanted to provoke a war. And this is strange. People ask, why on earth would a government or a state or a regime provoke a war against itself? And I think there are two answers. The first answer is that it knew that it couldn't survive a genuine reform process. If there was a real, genuine reform process, one thing would have led to another, and eventually the president and his elite, his group of friends, would have ended up, at best, in prison, stripped of their stolen wealth. They didn't want that. They thought they could win a war, and they may well be right. It looks a bit like that at the moment. The other thing is that they'd tried it before. In 1978 in Syria, there was a subversive political movement against the regime. It wasn't a huge popular mobilization like 2011, but it involved a range of voices from Islamists through nationalists, Democrats, liberals. After 4 years of ruthless repression of that movement, all that was left was the armed wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. And in 1982, out of idiocy or desperation, the Muslim Brotherhood's armed wing staged an armed uprising in the city of Hama, the ancient city of Hama in central Syria, at which point the regime said, great, it's a war situation. You've brought guns into the situation, so now we're going to declare war on you. And they went into the ancient city, destroyed the center of the city, and killed somewhere between 10 and 40,000 people. And that worked for them. The memory of that terror, that time of horror, kept Syrians silent for the next 3 decades until you had a new generation that couldn't personally remember the size of that terror. So I think they deliberately provoked it, and they did it in a variety of ways. As Leila said, there was a massive rape campaign. Mm. This is a regime that had always raped people in detention, but when the revolution broke out, they started ordering the army to go into rebellious neighborhoods, go into people's houses, and rape parents in front of children, children in front of parents. They also started torturing on a massive scale, including primary school children from the age of 6 and 7 up to death. The famous case is a little boy called Hamza al-Khatib, a 13-year-old boy who was picked up outside of the town of Dera in the south, and then his mutilated, tortured corpse was returned to his parents a few days later. His penis had been chopped off, he had gunshot wounds in his limbs, he'd been carved up with knives, burnt with cigarettes and with electrical burns. Usually when a fascist regime tortures somebody to death in detention, they get rid of the body, announce that this person killed themselves, and that's the end of the story. But in this case, they were returning the corpses to the families precisely because they wanted a violent response, because they knew that when it became violent, certain key constituencies inside Syria and Western states would be scared by the sight of, you know, bearded men with guns, and they would rather stick with the devil they knew. They would rather stick with the dictator. And he also knew, Al-Assad also knew, that his international sponsors like Russia and Iran would come wholeheartedly to his aid. And unfortunately, he's been quite correct in all of this.
Mm. Robin Yassin Kassab is a media commentator on Syria and author of the acclaimed novel The Road from Damascus. Leila Al-Shami is a human rights activist and founding member of Tahrir ICN. It's a network connecting anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. And we're talking about their book, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. They write about people who took to the streets in 2011 to demand democracy, social and economic justice. Over the past 5 years, 300,000 Syrians have been killed. 8 million have fled the country. And they give a voice to opposition fighters, courageous human rights activists who are still inside Syria, and refugees. If you have any questions for Leila and Robin about what is happening in Syria, specifically about the people who are still there and the movements that are still happening there, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. And also, if you have questions about how we got here, some history and some context that is often missing in some of the media coverage, give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about the groups that you write about. Students, for example, played a key role in the struggle. You write that from the outset and with the collaboration of university authorities, they were savagely repressed. So they organized in secret, forming the Union of Free Syrian Students in September 2011. These were students from public and private universities. Aleppo University in particular became a center of resistance, earning itself the title the University of the Revolution. Leila, tell us about some of the students that you interviewed. And also, how did you find them?
Well, that's right. Students joined the protest movement early on. Aleppo was a center of student resistance. Prior to the uprising, student activity was really repressed by the regime. The students' union was really dominated by the Ba'ath Party, so there was no ability for students to organise independently on campus. But when the revolution started, students got together and they founded a new students' union, the Revolutionary Students' Union. And through this union, they started to organise on campus. They also established a student newspaper called Voice of the Free, which was promoting the ideals of the revolution and doing a lot of work campaigning specifically for the release of student detainees, because many students were being rounded up and detained during that time. In fact, Aleppo University, maybe it was in 2013, I can't remember the exact date now, but it was actually hit by an airstrike as well. So students have played a key role. One of the things that you can find on YouTube is students all across the country, often wearing balaclavas, they posted videos of themselves to YouTube saying, "We stand with the revolution," and encouraging other students to be involved. They were plastering stickers around their campus and around the university, carrying out all different sorts of campaigns. We got in touch with students, I mean, connecting with people that we know and speaking to a wide variety of people. Many students gave up on their studies in the course of the revolution solely to devote themselves to revolutionary activity. So a lot of people lost their opportunity of education.
Robin, what would you add to that about the students who organized?
I would just sitting here thinking about refugees and the tragedy of people who've lost out on their education. I mean, we've come across refugees, you know, families who've been building up for generations to send somebody to university. It's really very sad. People who started off as, you know, maybe in the grandparents' generation, they were illiterate peasants. In the parents' generation, they were urban labourers. And here's the first generation that managed to go to university. And then those people have had to flee the country. They've either been escaping violence, escaping arrest, potential arrest, escaping conscription. They've left the country. They haven't got their papers with them, their academic papers, their documents. They've arrived in another country, a neighboring country, and they haven't been able to prove that they've been through the school system, and it's all gone. And they're kind of back at square one. And this is one of the tragedies when you talk to refugees. This is something that people feel very, very acutely, that people say, look, we don't care if we've got no money. We don't mind if we've got no house to live in. If we just had our qualifications. If we just had our academic documents, we could rebuild, we could start again somewhere else. And so many people have lost those. And of course, they can't go back to the, they can't go to the Syrian regime embassy and ask for papers, because if they've left the country under these circumstances, they won't get any help at all. So I just, as you were saying that, I was reminded of this tragedy which is affecting so many people.
Another story we heard over and over again was actually about medical students that maybe have only studied for 1 year at university and are now the ones running makeshift hospitals in basements inside Syria and carrying out major operations on people that are suffering war wounds and really severe physical traumas because of the bombing, because of the attacks. But because many of the doctors have fled the country, it's often these very unqualified or medical students that have stepped in to take over that role.
You also write about the role that women played and continue to play, a key role in civil resistance. You write that the two largest grassroots coalitions founded by women, two of the largest grassroots coalitions were founded by women. Sometimes women were the only ones who could protest. In Baida, for instance, most men had been detained, so women demonstrated alone. Leila, can you tell us more about this?
Well, that's absolutely true. Women... Syria's traditionally a very conservative and patriarchal society, and there are obstacles to women's participation. But women have played a key role in the revolution. As you mentioned, the two largest grassroots organizations to have emerged in the course of the revolution, the Local Coordination Committee and the Syrian Revolution General Commission, were both founded by women. One of them, a very inspirational young woman named Razan Zeytuna, to whom our book is dedicated, another one, Suher Al-Atasi. And within those bodies, which were coordinating, the local coordination committees was coordinating the protest movement, doing a lot of that, that work. It was also doing a lot of media work. A lot of women played a key role in that. Women play a big role in the civil resistance, in the different organisations that have been established, either human rights style organisations which are monitoring violations against civilians, not only by the regime, but increasingly by other actors as well. Also, in education work, providing education to children, often in makeshift schools in people's basements, because schools have been targeted for attack and many educational facilities are non-operational in Syria. So they've played a very key role. Often their role is overlooked because the military struggle is much more visible and it's a much more male-dominated domain, although women have played a key role in the military struggle as well. Some women have joined, have formed female battalions, have taken up arms to fight against the regime. This has been most noticeable amongst Kurds, but it's not only limited to Kurds, but you have the YPJ forces, which is a Kurdish female military unit which is fighting in northern Syria. Women have also provided logistical support to the Free Syrian Army, such as smuggling arms and weapons over across lines, because they often find it much easier to cross checkpoints than men do.
Yeah, also the highest level military defector, female military defector, has actually been a general called Zubeda al-Mekki, who's from the Alawi community too. She defected and she has been training Free Army fighters. There's also the issue of women's centres. This is really an interesting development, that all over the liberated areas, including in areas where there's a big presence of Islamist militias, even including Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliate, even in those areas, there are women's centres have been set up all over the country, and these are designed to encourage women's participation in the revolution, in the economic sphere, in the social sphere. They've been women have been providing training for women so that people can work, especially a lot of women now have become the main breadwinner as when their husbands have been killed or taken away or exiled. They're providing work for women, providing solidarity, a social space where women can discuss their issues and cooperate with each other to increase their participation in society.
And you also write that in Aleppo, women founded the first independent radio station which promotes activism and gender equality. Today we are speaking with Robin Yassin Kassab and Leila Alshami. They are authors of Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways to join in today's conversation on Your Call. On the phone, the toll-free number, 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. If you'd rather write your question or comment, you could send it to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Broadcast of Your Call is made possible by KALW listeners, including Anita Baldwin and Richard McCauley of Los Altos, Heinz Batterman of Oakland, and Dwight Clark of Palo Alto.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, to talk about his new book, The Fight to Vote. 17 states have introduced new voting restrictions, ranging from strict voter ID laws to cutting back on early voting. We'll talk about how this is affecting voter turnout and what will it take to protect the right to vote. Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we will be talking about what the media landscape looks like 20 years after President Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act, which opened the door for major media consolidation. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Leila Alshami, a human rights activist and founding member of Tahrir ICN, a network connecting anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe, and Robin Yassin Kassab, a media commentator on Syria and author of the acclaimed novel The Road from Damascus. Leila and Robin have written a book, Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War, and they give a voice to opposition fighters, refugees, and courageous human rights activists inside Syria. They both have family members and friends who are still in Syria. So if you have any questions for them about what's currently happening there, how we got to this place, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for letting me speak. First, I will have a comment. My comment is there's no way that I can check the accuracy of any of the claims that your guests are making.
Can I ask you why?
I'm sorry?
Why is that?
Because you don't have... This actually sounds like a very infomercialist format for regime change. Same thing that happened in Libya. I mean, and look at what's happened in Libya. A failed state. The entirety of North Africa is suffering for it. There's no way that you don't have anyone with a different point of view presenting anything different. I am not questioning that the Assad regime is a fascist regime. I'm not questioning that. But the way this whole thing is being presented is almost in an infomercial manner. There's no other point of view being presented, and there's no information. There's no way for me or your average person who's listening to this to truly, you know, substantiate the data that these people are coming out with.
So let me ask you this, Robert. What other viewpoint would you like to hear?
You know, there are a lot of other viewpoints out there that are not pro-regime, but they're not this vehement, we have to change this regime no matter what the cost. All the, and of course there are a lot of anecdotal stories about the horrific things that have happened to people, I don't know if you remember, but before the first Iraq war, when Saddam had invaded Kuwait, there were stories about the kinds of things that the Saddam's soldiers were doing to Kuwaiti children that it all turned out to be untrue.
All right, so let me ask our guests again. Our guests today, Leila Alshami and Robin Yassin Kassab, have friends and family inside Syria. First of all, we have a couple emails that kind of repeat Robert's opinion, saying that this is nonsense. The narrative that you're pushing is false. Leila, I know you've heard this time and time again. So what's your response?
Well, in terms of verifying this information, I mean, the Syrian revolution is the most documented revolution in history. It's not hard to find information and from voices on the ground. Many of the groups that we've mentioned this morning, many of the civil society organizations, they all have web pages in English. They all use social media. They all put out information about their activities and what they're doing. I mean, yes, maybe we do have a one-sided view. I feel I'm absolutely unapologetic about the fact that I'm standing on the side of the oppressed, which is facing a mass murdering fascist regime, which is standing against a neoliberal regime, which has spent the past 5 years bombing the hell out of working class neighbourhoods across the country.
I mean, the other thing is this assumption in amongst so-called progressives and leftists in the West that this is all a regime change plot. I'm afraid this is judging present events by what happened a decade ago. We are not supporters of American regime change plots. We have not in our book or anywhere else called on America to come in and change the regime by bombs or whatever. This is really insulting to the Syrian people. The Syrian people have been doing this themselves, and they've been ignored by supposed leftists and progressives in the West for 5 years. According to the, you know, and people have been giving in to these ridiculous conspiracy theories that the Americans are trying to get rid of this glorious resistance regime which has been supporting the Palestinians and standing up against imperialism. I'm afraid if you actually look at the facts, none of this fits. The American military, the American ruling class, like the American people, are perfectly aware that in the previous decade, in the Bush years, they went far too far. They were hubristic. They thought that they could charge into the Middle East and remake it in their own image, and that didn't work. And they know it didn't work. It was a disaster for America, and they are not trying to do it now. Quite the opposite. The crowning achievement of Barack Obama's administration has been its deal with Iran. It's just done a deal with Iran at precisely the moment that Iran has taken such an aggressive and expansionist turn in the Arab world and has tens of thousands of occupation troops and transnational Shia jihadists fighting on Assad's front lines against democratic civilian communities. People like your caller are obsessed with this non-existent regime change and are not aware of what Syrian people are doing on the ground. You know, there are over 400 most of them democratically elected, self-organized councils in liberated Syria that are keeping life together. And people in America aren't aware of it. They're aware of jihadists. They're aware of supposed Sunni-Shia conflicts and supposed imperialist plots and so on. But they're not aware of what these ordinary, working-class, intelligent, creative people are doing under the most difficult of circumstances. And frankly, it's insulting to the Syrian people to imagine that they're happy to have their children tortured to death, happy to be raped and humiliated and assaulted, to have their homes blown up until some devilishly clever white man from the West comes and whispers in their ears and tells them they should be upset about it. Most Syrians have entirely given up on expecting any help from the West. I think that the least we could do is actually find out what's happening. And when this guy says that there's no evidence or proof that what we're saying is true, well, I don't know what he trusts and doesn't trust. I mean, the United Nations Human Rights Organization has just said that the regime is guilty of the crime of extermination, as well as a host of other war crimes. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, as well as the grassroots Syrian organizations like the Violation Documentation Center and others, keep coming up again and again and again with proper researched information on the enormous scale of these crimes, which just cannot be reasonably denied unless you have some ridiculous, silly agenda which puts America first and ignores people on the ground in the Middle East.
Can you talk more about this? Because we're receiving similar emails to Robert's phone call saying that you're not talking about Wahhabis or ISIS, for example.
Well, we are. We're very happy to talk about Wahhabis and ISIS.
We weren't asked a question on that so far.
We haven't been asked about it, but we're happy to talk about these Islamist groups and how unpleasant some of them are, how these transnational this foreign occupation, I mean, ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, there are other Islamist groups inside Syria which do have a Syrian constituency, although we personally don't like their politics. But the foreign groups, ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda franchise, these are foreign groups with a global agenda, not a Syrian agenda, who have taken advantage of the chaos, specifically of the scorched earth that Assad has unleashed. They've jumped in order to take advantage, and we oppose them, and most Syrian revolutionaries oppose them tooth and nail. Again, if you actually look at what's happening, rather than sticking to these tired old narratives, if you look at what's happening, you'll see that in the last weeks, when there's been a reduction of hostilities, when the death count has gone down from about 120 a day a few weeks ago to about 40 a day now, still appalling, but better than it was. In this slight breathing space, we've seen massive demonstrations of people in the liberated areas waving the freedom flag, the revolutionary flag, not the black flags of the jihadist organizations, and protesting against the Assad regime and also against Nusra, against ISIS, against these foreign jihadist groups, very bravely. So this is a struggle inside Syria against all forms of authoritarianism. The other thing that people are failing to understand when they swallow Assadist and Russian and Iranian propaganda about the opposition being jihadist, what they've missed is that the Assad regime very deliberately helped to create a jihadist opposition. And I'll tell you how. In the spring and summer of 2011, when the protests were raging, the peaceful, non-sectarian protests were raging, at the same time that the regime was rounding up tens of thousands of peaceful, non-sectarian protesters for death by torture or indefinite detention, they also released 1,500 prisoners from their jails. The majority of these 1,500 men were Salafist jihadists who the regime had helped to go to Iraq to fight against the American occupation after 2003. Those men also attacked the Shia population in Iraq and helped to participate a sectarian civil war in the country. When they came back to Syria, they were arrested again, put in prison, and he kept them in prison until he needed them in 2011. High-level defectors say it went beyond just releasing them, that they actually received logistical help from the regime, and a lot of these men went on to become the leaders of groups like Jaish al-Islam, Ahrar al-Sham, Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIS. And it was a very effective technique because it helped to alienate religious minorities, key constituencies inside Syria that the revolution needed to win over. And more to the point, it helped to alienate Western powers who saw these bearded men with guns and thought, ooh, we better stick with what they think is the lesser evil, the devil we know. I could go on. I mean, the regime also, in the summer of 2012, it also organized a series of sectarian massacres in which first the army would shell rebellious Sunni villages, and then Alawi thugs from the nearby Alawi village, this is the minority sect that the president belongs to, would come in and cut the throats of men, women and children. Now, the target of that, of course, the first victim of that was the people in these Sunni villages, but the political target of that was actually the Alawi community, because there were many people in the Alawi community that sympathized with the revolution. They understood why their neighbors were protesting. But when they saw their neighbors so enraged by this sectarian slaughter that they sometimes went on YouTube, went on mobile phone cameras and shouted, "You Alawi bastards, you kill our children, we will come and kill your children in return." At that point, these people felt so scared that they thought, look, we know this guy is destroying the country. He's making it impossible for our children to live with our neighbours' children in the future. But if our neighbours are now wanting to kill us for revenge reasons, just because of who we are, maybe we have no choice but to stick with the revolution. So this was a coldly intelligent tactic. And it's been done before. It's not just the Syrian revolution. I would encourage your listeners to study what the Algerian regime did in 91-92 when it met a democratic challenge, responded with extreme violence, helped to build up a jihadist opposition to scare its own people and to scare the outside world into obedience. And it worked. Now the military regime in Algeria is still there. It's still in power. The Russians, too, in Chechnya, from their first war against Chechnya to their second war in Chechnya. By the time of the Second War, they had been able to help manufacture a jihadist opposition which scared people, scared the outside world, and meant that they didn't receive a lot of complaints when they razed the city of Grozny the second time.
That is Robin Yassin Kassab. He is a media commentator on Syria and author of the novel The Road from Damascus. We're also joined by Leila Alshami, a human rights activist and founding member of Tahrir ICN, a network connecting anti-authoritarian struggles across the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. And their new book is Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. And I should say, I didn't ask about Wahhabis and ISIS because I knew that once I did that, we would completely get away from the yes. stories that you tell about the people on the ground. That's what almost always happens when we do a show about Syria. And it's so important to give a voice to the people who are still in Syria. And Robin and Leila do have family members and friends who are still there. We're also going to talk about refugees later in the show. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Dori Stein in San Francisco. Hi, Dori. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose, and hello to the guests. Two points that I think are related. One is I'd like to know the guests' take on the Kurds, who actually, the Syrian Kurds, are not absolutely. I mean, there are two factions within the Kurds. One is anti-Assad and one is more accommodating to Assad. I'd like to know their opinion of the Kurds being prevented from participating in the so-called peace talks in Geneva, sponsored by the UN, Germany, and who else in Europe? Turkey, obviously, is the reason why they're not being allowed. But Germany and I think France both want the Kurds to participate. Of course, the Kurds have been the most effective fighting force against ISIS in Syria. And the second question I have has to do with a chemical weapons attack on Sheikh Maksoud, which is a Kurdish city in eastern Aleppo. And the leader of Jaish al-Islam, Mohammed Alush, is the chief negotiator for the Syrian opposition at these peace talks. And he admitted that there were chemical weapons attack, although he said that the commander who did it would be disciplined. But still, here is the chief negotiator at the talks, part of a opposition group that had a chemical weapons attack. Kurds and Sheikh Maksoud. I'd like their opinion about that.
All right. Thank you, Dori.
Well, in relation to the Kurds and participating in the peace talks, well, first of all, I mean, the Kurds have achieved really remarkable things during the course of the revolution. They have declared democratic autonomy in three cantons across Syria, where in that area people are really practicing direct democracy. They're really taking control over their local affairs, which is very similar to what the Arabs have been doing through the local council system across the liberated territories. The PYD, which is the Democratic Union Party, now in control of the Kurdish areas, has been there's tensions between the PYD and other parts of the Syrian opposition, they're not considered part of the Syrian opposition. And I think this is why a lot of the Arab groups have not wanted them to participate in the peace talks. Turkey also has been preventing them from participating in the peace talks, which is basically because of Turkey's agenda to stop Kurdish autonomy in the north. I think this is a huge mistake. I think that forces on the ground that have influence, that have a constituency, should all be around that table if we're really serious about moving forward towards peace. I don't think it's 100% correct to say that Kurds are prevented from participating in the peace talks as Kurds, because I think in the last talks in Riyadh, something like 30% of the delegation were actually Kurds. They just weren't from the PYD, the Democratic Union Party, because of the tensions between the Arab opposition and the Kurdish opposition. I would question whether the Kurds have been the most effective force in fighting against ISIS. Let's remember that in 2014, the Free Syrian Army pushed ISIS out of the whole of northern and eastern Syria. ISIS then came back in force following the capture of American weapons in Iraq. But the Kurds have obviously really benefited from American support and from the American airstrikes recently to fight against ISIS, and America has not been willing to work with the Free Syrian Army on the ground in that fight. In terms of the chemical weapon attack, you're absolutely correct. There was a chemical weapons attack on Sheikh Maksoud by an individual who is associated to Jaish al-Islam, which is one of the Islamist groups operating in Syria, one of the nationalist Islamist groups. It's not a jihadi group. Jaish al-Islam strongly condemned that attack and said that somebody, the person responsible for that attack, would be disciplined.
I'd just add to that that, you know, obviously what we need is as much solidarity as we can possibly get between Kurds and Arabs. And it's complicated that there are Kurds who feel represented by the PYD. There are also many Kurds who don't feel represented by the PYD. There are Kurdish battalions in the Free Syrian Army. There are Kurdish members of the councils in Arab-majority areas. The PYD, as Leila said, I think on a nationalist level, it's achieved wonderful things for the Kurds. Now Kurds can educate their children in the Kurdish language, which they couldn't before. They can have their areas policed by Kurdish policemen rather than chauvinist Arab policemen who don't speak the local language and don't necessarily respect the people very much. On the cantonal level, they've in Rojava, in the three areas where there are Kurdish majority in northern Syria, there's a lot of local democracy, which is very good. At the same time, I think we should be careful of romanticizing the PYD. The PYD, like all political parties in the region or in the world, is an authoritarian political party. It monopolizes the weapons and the aid money going into the Kurdish areas. It has at times opened fire on peaceful protesters. It has repressed other Kurdish groups. So the PYD is in some ways problematic. I think the most problematic thing that the PYD has done in recent weeks is it seems to have made the judgment that with the massive Russian intervention and the carpet bombing of democratic communities by Russia, that the tide has changed, the balance of forces has turned against the revolution. And in this context, it has in northern Aleppo been advancing into Arab-majority areas, areas which have always had Arab majorities, and which are controlled by democratic councils and free army militias. And it's captured some of those areas and now drawn a line around them and said, this is going to be our federal area in northern Syria. Now, I think that federalism and decentralization, local governments, may well be part of the solution in Syria. However, doing it in this undemocratic way under Russian bombs will probably backfire. It's probably is a good idea in the long term, but every community there needs to understand what it means and needs to agree with it before it works. So I worry that the PYD is moving away from its democratic confederalist model towards a more statist model, which is entirely understandable because the Kurds, of course, have suffered a great deal in the Middle East in the past decades. And certainly the elite opposition, the elite Arab opposition, the exile opposition, has not done nearly enough to recognize Kurdish grievances historically, or even to say that the future Syria will be called the Syrian Republic and not the Syrian Arab Republic. I mean, just the very name of the place seems to favor one ethnic group against another. So there are failings on both sides, and great work has been done on both sides. So the more solidarity and mutual understanding we can have between Kurds and Arabs, of course, the better for everybody concerned.
We have just a few minutes, and I wanted to ask you both about where you see the situation with refugees going, and then what's in store for the future of Syria. I mean, there are just horrendous stories about these vigilantes patrolling the Bulgaria-Turkey border, for example. They're hunting for refugees. I saw some video at AJ Plus. They're throwing young men on the ground, and then they're putting them in handcuffs and yelling at them. I mean, that's just one example of many. Leila, just quickly, where do you see the refugee crisis going?
Well, first of all, I think the main crisis of refugees is still within the region. We have something like 5 million people have left the country in Syria, looking for refuge, looking for safety outside. The vast majority of them are in neighbouring countries, in Turkey, in Lebanon and in Jordan. In Lebanon, for example, the official figures say that one in every five people in the country is now a Syrian refugee. Unofficially, the figures are probably much higher than that. So this is putting a huge strain on host country resources. In Lebanon and in Jordan, Syrian refugees are not allowed to work. So they're not allowed to find a legal means to provide an income for themselves and their families. The vast majority of children are out of school in those countries. There's increasing tensions between local communities and between host populations and the refugee population because of the competition over resources, because so many refugees are now working illegally in the informal sector, undercutting already poor communities who are dependent on the informal sector for their income generation. So it's really this crisis in the region which is causing so many people to flee to Europe. I think the vast majority of Syrians, to be honest, would rather stay in the region because the culture's the same, the language is the same, the food is much better, they feel much more at home there. But because of the desperate situation that they're living in, that they're having to flee to Europe.
Robin, we only have 30 seconds left. What are your final thoughts? I mean, we'll have to have you back to talk about maybe solutions and possible prospects for the future of Syria.
Well, my final thoughts are, you know, Leila was talking about the 5 million outside the country. There are 7 million homeless inside the country in desperate conditions. Nevertheless, we shouldn't just be feeling sorry for Syrians. We certainly shouldn't be ignoring them and treating them with these ridiculous conspiracy theories, but we should also be learning from them. This is the most thoroughgoing and profound revolution since the 1930s in Spain. We should be learning lessons from these remarkable people who are doing remarkable things in the most difficult of circumstances.
Robin Yassin Kassab and Leila Alshami are authors of Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. They both still have family and friends who are inside Syria. Robin and Leila, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, joins us to discuss his new book, The Fight to Vote. It took nearly two centuries to expand voting rights from property-owning white men to all of us, but the hard-won battle is still under attack. 17 states have introduced new voting restrictions, ranging from strict voter ID laws to cutting back on early voting. So what will it take to protect the right to vote? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.